Yes?
Todd? Can I come down and have a chat with you?
Keep it together, Victor.
Yeah, of course you can.
There is a large pipe next to the bed if we need it, Sage. Don't drop your guard.
What can I do for you today, Bill?
I thought I might visit you and see how you are settling in, son.
Just fine. I admit that first week it took me just a bit to get the hang of the projectors.
Yes. I found that curious. As I recall, they're the exact model you used in Chicago, right?
Yeah, sure. Though there are some very small differences. Heck, you probably wouldn't even notice them if you hadn't been a projectionist as long as I have.
That is mighty interesting. I hear good things about you, Todd, from the girls in the concession stand. They always say you are quite ready to lend a hand with all of the heavy lifting. I appreciate that.
It's nothing. Glad I can do some good where I can, Bill.
I am so glad to hear that. I was wondering though, Todd, the last few nights when I've been going home, I couldn't help but notice you making your way up into the woods.
What?
Come now, Todd. What are you getting up to?
I don't know what you're talking about, Bill. I'm not going into the woods at night.
Now, Todd, I might be a bit older than you, son, but my eyes are just as keen as when I was in the army. I've seen you twice now, sneaking off up into those woods after I lock up for the night.
Bill, I truly haven't been leaving at the end of my shift. I promise.
Son, you can tell me. Are you having a thing with one of the girls? I was young once too, you know.
No, good Lord, no, I'm married.
You are? I don't see a band around a finger, Todd. I don't remember you bringing that up when we talked in Chicago. Now look, I can see this is upsetting you, so I'll leave the matter for now. But have you ever heard the saying, you don't fish off the company pier?
Yeah, of course.
Well, then how about you just remember that, Todd? You just remember that, son?
Sure. Thank you, Bill.
You can smile. Every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home.
I thought you were supposed to find a way to fix that, Todd. Sometimes it's like the Starlight Starbright Family Fun Drive-In has a mind of its own.
Still trying to track down that short in the speaker system, Bill.
See that you do, son. I'm keeping my eyes on you.
That was weird, projectionist.
You are an idiot. Why would you say you are married?
It just slipped out. Sorry. What does it matter anyway? This isn't even our timeline.
It doesn't matter, Victor. If we are in the timeline of rainbows and bunny hugs, Bill Darnell is always Bill Darnell. He is the keystone of what befell the Retroist Vault in our time, and I can assure you he is just as dangerous in this one. I can smell it.
All right. I just kind of panicked when he was grilling me. I wonder what he was talking about, though. All of that seeing me, us, heading off into the woods.
It's all right. I'm not entirely free of blame, but I assure you that I was being very careful about going out at night. He must be getting help from otherworldly sources, eh?
What are you talking about? What do you mean you're going out at night? You can't.
When you go to sleep, I get bored, Victor. It's only natural. So I figured I would get started on the process of creating that new portal.
How?
It is rather simple. Like I said, though, I have to hunt for the correct parts in its construction.
No! I mean, how are you going out? I'm in control. You are stuck in my subconscious.
Oh, that is simple. You go to sleep, which allows me to regain control of my body. Where is the confusion coming from?
But I'm in control.
Until you go to sleep, Sage.
I can't believe this. Why wouldn't you tell me?
I thought you knew. Haven't you ever wondered how that mud and other such stains gets on your shoes?
I guess I never really noticed.
No matter. I'll be more careful in the future. I promise.
No! You keep us in here at night. Listen to radio. Talk to the drive-in. Watch some movies on the 8mm projector, for Pete's sakes.
Certainly. As you wish.
I mean it, projectionist.
I'm sure you do, Victor. Oh, look, the briefcase recording light is on. I suppose it has come time for another Saturday Frights radio broadcast.
Huh. I wonder how long it's been recording.
What was that film we watched the other night called again? Was it Land Sharks?
Tremors, projectionist. And don't think we aren't going to talk more about what you've been doing after the podcast.
Of course. I look forward to it.
As I told you last night, Tremors was originally entitled Land Sharks during the pre-production phase of the movie. They had to change that title due to a rather famous Saturday Night Live skit. The writers, Brent Maddock and S.S. Wilson, along with the director Ron Underwood, realized that the Land Shark or Jaws 2 skit from Saturday Night Live might confuse moviegoers. So Tremors was settled on as the title for the film. Released in 1990, Tremors was a film I originally caught not at the Razorback Theater of my youth, but its rival, the newer, and at that time, state-of-the-art Cobb Theater. That was about 5 minutes up the street.
A rival theater, eh? Yet you went to this Cobb House instead of the Razorback? For shame, Sage.
Well, I didn't really have much of a choice in the matter, projectionist. Back in those days, the Cobb Theater and the Razorback would play nice. So with Tremors showing at the former, it meant that the latter wouldn't be carrying it. That all changed, though, with the re-release of Star Wars in 1997, when the trilogy special editions came out. Then, the gloves were off between the two theaters. And they never went back to playing nice, so to speak. Had you seen Tremors before we watched it on the laptop last night?
I had not. I will admit that I quite enjoyed this throwback to Monster B movies. I was taken back, however, at the amount of comedy in the film.
Oh, it's got a ton of comedy to be sure, up until a point. But Underwood and the writers always make sure to break up the tension with a good joke, even when things are at their most dire for the heroes. What I've always loved about the movie is how real the characters feel. They totally seem like people you might know in your neighborhood, and you will care about the danger they're put in when the subterranean monsters show up to make a meal out of Perfection, Nevada, and its 14 inhabitants.
I agree, Victor. There are strong ties between each of the characters, even if some have beefs with each other, like Valentine McKee and Bert Gummer.
Exactly. They might get riled up with each other, but when the chips are down, they stand together. Anyway, I got off subject and didn't get to finish my first encounter with this movie. See, friends, the truth of the matter is, my father, for all intents and purposes, has an absolutely horrible taste in movies. I'm not talking about classic B-movies that most everyone will love. I'm talking about the fact that he seems magnetically drawn to Z-movies. Then, for some reason, he's confused why they didn't turn out to be a better film. So many movies of my youth, Predator, RoboCop, Poltergeist, and of course Tremors to name a few, are movies that when you get down to it, my father didn't want to see. He thought they looked stupid. Of course, when we saw those films, he completely changed his tune. It's become something of a running joke between us, reminding him of all those films he didn't want to see that have become repeat viewings on VHS and DVD for him. It's a curse I've had to deal with my whole life, projectionist. Okay, let's jump into the synopsis real quick. When Tremors opens, we are introduced to our two main protagonists, Valentine McKee, played by Footloose's Kevin Bacon, and Earl Bassett, portrayed by the Right Stuff's Fred Ward. The film sets the tone right off as we meet Val. One of our main heroes is, well, relieving himself into a canyon.
Indeed. While watching these early scenes, I sensed a long history between these two hired hands.
Handyman projectionist? They prefer to be called handymen, as Earl is quick to point out.
Valentine McKee and Earl Bassett are rather down on their luck, and don't even have a sawbuck between them.
That might be because of how skilled they are. Or not. Judging by Val's ability to hammer in a fencing nail while they were repairing a barbed wire fence. I mean, it takes them like 8 swings of the hammer just to hit the nail. It also seems like doing everyone's dirty work is starting to wear on the two. Of course, I guess burying trash and cleaning out septic tanks, any odd job that the townspeople of perfection don't or can't be bothered with, can fill up your cup pretty fast.
Dear listeners, I would be willing to bet that Perfection was once a mining town, judging by its construction.
It was definitely a mining town, remember? It's mentioned by the town doctor later in the film. These beginning scenes are really well done, as they not only set us straight on the characters of Val and Earl being rascally, but deep down having hearts of gold. Honestly, they are basically cowboys. Which is appropriate as Tremors is really a Western when you get down to it, don't you think?
Yes, a modern-day Western to be sure. In particular, when the townspeople are cut off due to the monster's attacks and must rely on only themselves.
Exactly. Val, being the younger of the two, is a smart aleck with a bit of a temper, and Earl is the calmer and gives off an air of being much wiser. And possibly the lazier of the two.
Earl Bassett likes to believe he is the brains of the operation, dear listeners.
Agreed. After meeting our first two heroes, we are introduced to our third main protagonist and love interest of the movie for Val. Quite against his wishes, I might add. The beautiful and intelligent graduate student, Rhonda LeBeck, who's played by Finn Carter, a seismology major who's in perfection because of the odd readings she's been getting from her equipment. On their first meeting, Val and Earl are headed into town to do odd jobs, you know, so they can buy the necessities, like food. When Rhonda asks if the two have heard anyone mentioning they are blasting or possibly digging in the area.
Yes, whatever could be making those disturbances, eh?
We will be getting to the underground monsters of the film in just a bit, my friend. Val is rather cold towards Rhonda.
Be honest, Victor. He is downright boorish.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Well, Earl promises the young woman they'll ask around about any reasons for the unusual seismic activity when they get into town. Which is exactly where the two end up, and we are introduced to the rest of the main cast of the film. You have Nancy Sterngood, who seems to be a single mother. Her daughter, Mindy, played by future Jurassic Park star Ariana Richards, and a rather annoying teenager named Melvin Pug. There's also Miguel and Nestor Cunningham, who I always thought might be the mailman for the town or something.
Nestor Cunningham does have something of an official air about him, now that you mention it, Victor.
We also are introduced to what seems to be the sole business owner in perfection, Walter Chang, played by John Carpenter alumni Victor Wong, proprietor of Chang's Market, which is where we get to meet two actors who absolutely steal every scene they are in. Survivalists Bert and Heather Gummer, played by Family Ties Michael Gross and country singer turned actress Reba McEntire. Not only was this Reba's first film role, but Michael Gross reported on the set just one day after wrapping the last episode of the hit NBC TV series Family Ties. I think this clip might sum up the Gummers for you.
Thanks, Walter. Look, these are hollow points, but they're not Hydroshock hollow points.
Excuse me, I thought bullets were bullets.
Hi, guys. What you been doing?
Well, we ran into that new college student, that Rona.
Rhonda. Yeah, she's having some trouble with her, things.
You know, those college kids turn up oil or uranium or something out there? Next thing, the feds will be at our door. Sorry, time to move. Eminent domain.
Down, honey, down.
Yeah, Bert. Well, you worry. You're gonna have a heart attack before you get a chance to survive World War III.
We'll see. We'll see.
Hey, guys. Listen. Bearing going out. What do you think?
Could be.
Catch you later, Chang. We got a schedule to keep.
Oh, yeah. See, we plan ahead. That way we don't do anything right now. Earl, explain it to me.
I'm not going to spoil it for those who might not have seen the movie yet, but there is a scene later in the film involving the Gummers and the underground monsters that I kid you not caused hysterical laughter from the audience when I first saw this with my father. We actually missed some dialogue in the next scene because we were all laughing so hard. In that clip you just heard, some machinery was going haywire. It's an old soda machine. I bring this up to point out the tight writing in Tremors, because while the filmmakers don't always use the rule of three, they pepper future events throughout the film. Why, right from the very first scene when we meet Val, relieving himself, that canyon will become very important.
I agree, Victor.
Thank you, projectionist. In these early moments of the film, we are given quite a few instances of Earl and Val being fed up with perfection. But it's while the duo are cleaning out the septic tank for Melvin's house, blaming each other for being stuck in perfection for as long as they have been, that they decide to leave the town for good and head into the larger town of Bixby permanently. This is settled, by the way, when the septic tank equipment they've rented from Chang malfunctions and sprays the two men with, well, what can I say? The contents of the septic tank. Yuck. Val and Earl, after obviously getting cleaned up, are racing out of town in their old pickup truck when temptation arrives for them to stay. When Nancy flags them down to offer them a job to help build her pottery kiln. A job where she would provide lunches, and from what we've seen in the movie so far, something far more important to the two than money. Free beer. The next scene we see them hooting and hollering at having resisted such a temptation, and maybe foolishly saying nothing stands between them and Bixby now.
That is what they've planned, perhaps. But fate has other thoughts on the matter. As they are leaving the sleepy little town, they spot something queer indeed. A member of the community named Edgar has managed to climb up an electrical tower.
This is a good time to point that when Val and Earl have a disagreement on who has to do something, they settle it with a round of rock, paper, scissors. Val almost always loses the game, and even when he does win, it seems that Earl manages to profit in some way no matter what. Thanks to the young man's grumblings as he climbs that tower to bring Edgar down, we are made aware the elderly man is the town drunk. There is a shock waiting for Val and we the audience when he reaches Edgar, though. The old man is quite dead, horribly sunburned, and holding a Winchester rifle in his lifeless hands. And we can't help but notice he has tied himself to the tower with his belt so he wouldn't fall. In the very next scene, we meet the town's doctor, Jim, and his wife Megan, at the location where they are building their dream house, just outside of perfection. We also get a bit of nasty news in regards to what really happened to Edgar.
Was it a heart attack, doctor?
No. Died of dehydration.
Thirst.
Well, that doesn't make any sense. That takes a couple of days, doesn't it?
Maybe even three or four.
You mean he sat up there 3 or 4 days? He sat up there and just died of thirst?
Yeah, you reckon he hated perfection more than us? You suppose he wanted to kill himself?
Come on, somebody must have chased him up there.
What, you mean someone ain't scared of a Winchester rifle? Then what'd they do? Camp out down below and just wait for him to die?
You might be interested to know that originally, the film was to open with Edgar's mule being killed in its pen. This is, of course, what caused Edgar to climb up that tower with his rifle. Now, this scene might have been edited out, as another character we meet next, named Old Fred, is dispatched in the following scene, when we see his sheep become spooked by what is obviously the presence of the subterranean monsters. Old Fred is a farmer who's seen better days, judging by the shape of his shack and his garden. Seconds after his scarecrow tilts over on its own, he is swallowed up by something from below as a blast of dust is shot into the air. The old man screams in agony as he is dragged down into the ground.
Oh, we will see what dragged him into the ground soon enough.
Yeah, but first we get to see the remains of Old Fred after that attack. Earl and Val are still intending to leave perfection after leaving the doctor's place. They slam on the brakes, though, when they pass by the farm, because the sheep have been horribly slaughtered and their holding pens completely wrecked. Val and Earl are quite concerned for the man's safety when they happen to spy his hat out in the small garden he was tending. Val reaches down to pick it up, and both men are horrified to see underneath it is Fred's face, staring up at them with a scream of horror frozen on it. Our two heroes quickly jump back into their truck and tear off once again, this time headed back to Perfection, as they fear there is a serial killer loose in the town.
Well, they have found two of the townsfolk slain under bizarre circumstances.
True. They only stop long enough to warn two members of a road construction crew, who think they're just trying to play a joke on them. But moments after Val and Earl have driven off, one of the men, using a jackhammer, punches through the pavement. There is a great bellowing from beneath the ground, and orangish blood begins pooling up. The construction worker finds himself being dragged off, thanks to the hose to the jackhammer that's wrapped around his leg. His partner watches in confusion as the jackhammer and his friend are literally being dragged across the concrete. And when he rushes to his co-worker's aid, the wounded monster, still unseen at this point, winds up killing him when it causes a small cliff wall to come tumbling down in an avalanche.
This avalanche also manages to drop the citizens of Perfection, as it was the only road to Bixby.
Val and Earl will find that out momentarily, because as they explain to their friends back in town what they've found with the death of Edgar and old Fred, they are sent out to Bixby in an effort to get the police. You might rightfully be thinking, why don't they just call the police? But it seems that the underground monsters intentionally, well, or maybe not, have cut off the phone lines. And the CB at Chang's Market can't reach the bigger town because of the canyons and mountains interfering with the signal. Walter's last name, for what it's worth, was decided on by Victor Wong himself. I've read that in the original script, his character was supposed to be Vietnamese. But Wong is Chinese, and when the filmmakers asked for a suggestion, he decided on Chang.
Interesting. I wonder if this was someone in the actor's life. A way of winking at a close friend, perhaps.
I don't know. It could be. Anyway, when Val and Earl head back out to Bixby, they of course are stopped by the avalanche across the road. They also notice the remains of the two construction workers, bloody hard hats laying amidst the rubble. The two decide yet again to hightail it back to town. Except, when Val backs up, it seems like the younger man has managed to get their truck stuck. He's pressing down on the gas, but it just won't budge.
Bassett warns his friend he is about to burn the clutch out of the infernal contraption. But just a moment later, the matter is resolved as the truck finally gets going again after the young man manages to floor it.
It's when the two reach Walter's store they learn just what was holding the truck back. The townsfolk of Perfection are shocked to see what looks to be a mix of a large snake and eel wrapped around the truck's back axle. Apparently, when Val slammed on the gas pedal, it managed to shred the thing in two. It's Bert who points out that even though it's long, we're talking like 5 feet at least, there is no way it could have held the truck in place with Val laying in on the gas pedal, nor could it have eaten all of old Fred's sheep by itself. It slowly dawns on them all that there must be more of the snake-like creatures out there. The group spend the night and into the early morning at Chang's Market discussing what can be done. They decide that it would be best if Val and Earl take Walter's horses and ride to Bixby to bring back the much-needed help.
You should also point out that the most important thing on Walter Chang's mind is what to call the monster they found. He settles on calling them graboids.
Yeah, Walter shows signs that he knows how to make a buck no matter what. Sadly, for Jim and his wife, during the night, they are attacked by the graboids. It's a hard scene to watch, as the doctor's wife tries valiantly to keep her husband from being dragged underneath the earth. Finally, he is pulled down, and the woman climbs into their station wagon. But it turns out her husband had the keys. It's a really gut-wrenching moment as the snake-like graboids slam against the car's windows, leaving a slimy trail of orange goo in their attempt to get at the terrified woman. Then, we viewers are shocked to find out how many of them there must be under the ground, as they begin to actually pull the station wagon itself underneath the earth. The last thing we see from a distance is the car's headlights shining up into the night sky before going out. This scene, as tense as it is, was originally going to be much longer, with Jim's wife kicking out the front windshield before scrambling up the hood of the car as it's pulled under, only for her to realize she has nowhere safe to jump, and she has to hold onto the vehicle as it slowly sinks beneath the ground. Well, it turns out the sinking mechanism that was to allow the car to get dragged down ended up malfunctioning, and they just plain ran out of time. Back in Perfection, as the morning sun rises, Val and Earl head off on horseback. See? I told you it was a western. They decide to check in on the doctor and his wife, tell them, you know, to get back into town. But of course, there's no one there. Except, if that is the case, why do the two men hear music playing? It sounds muffled, and you can imagine how shocked they are to trace its source to the station wagon they find buried underneath all the dirt. Val and Earl decide the best bet is to just head straight to Bixby now, riding like the devil itself is on their heels, which is when they come into the path of a graboid. Those snake-like creatures we've seen so far are revealed to only be just the tip of the creature. Something like a mass of tongues, they resemble grasping tentacles as they shoot out from the much, much larger worm-like bulk of the monster itself. Our two heroes realize they are no match for this creature and run for their very lives. The graboid gives chase, however, and it's very fast. Thanks to some nice special effects, we get to see the graboid as it rushes through the dirt towards them. Earl and Val reach the end of a concrete aqueduct and try to jump over the gap to the safety of the other side. Sadly, they fail and slide down the steep incline just in time to face the graboid as it hits that concrete wall at full speed, killing itself in the process. Which is an opportune time for Rhonda to walk up to the edge of the aqueduct for the discovery of a lifetime and rain on Val and Earl's parade of killing one of the graboids with some very bad news.
Must be totally subterranean. And those tentacles.
Yeah. You know, I think they shoot right out of its mouth. And they hook you. And they pull you right in. Good thing we stopped before it killed anybody else.
Look, this is important, you know. This is like... Well, let's just say it. This is probably the biggest zoological discovery of the century.
Hey! Hey, check this out! Jesus, we really caught something here!
Wow.
Man, that's one big mother.
Must be the old boy had your seismos working overtime.
Yeah. Yeah, it must push itself along with these. You know, all of them pushing at once. That's why it moves so fast. I mean, this thing had sensors tripping all over the place. No.
Hey, Rhonda, you ever heard of anything like this before?
Oh, sure, Earl. Everybody knows about them. We just didn't tell you.
Hey, shut up! The way I figure it, there are three more of these things.
What?
Three more?
I've got seismographs all over this valley. Now, if you compare the different readings, here's one at 2 o'clock yesterday. But here's one 3 miles away at the exact same time. Now, that's two. But here...
Yeah, we'll take your word for it.
Yeah, where's your truck?
Just beyond that hill.
For our three heroes, however, getting to that truck proves quite a bit more difficult than expected. As they come under attack by another of the three graboids, who chases them to an outcropping of boulders, and waits for them to come down.
Absolutely. Val, Rhonda, and Earl are able to figure out that while the graboids have no eyes, they do possess excellent hearing, especially as the trio talk sitting on the boulders. Which is, of course, why Edgar never came down from that electrical tower. The graboid that chased him just stayed put because it could sense the vibrations he was making on the tower. The three are forced to spend the night on the boulders, and in the morning, it's Rhonda who spies a way to escape the grasping tendrils of the graboid, thanks to some leftover poles that I assume were either used to dislodge things in the aqueduct or possibly in building fences. With them, the trio managed to pole vault from their boulder to the next, so they can reach the truck. Fun fact, screenwriter S.S. Wilson has gone on record stating that while he was enlisted at a Navy base in the Mojave Desert, he was allowed to hike when they weren't using the gunnery ranges. One day, during a hike, as he was climbing up boulders, the thought occurred to him, what if there was something under the ground that kept him from getting off the boulder? That is how the idea for trimmers began to percolate in his head. Well, the graboid doesn't waste time, however, in attempting to eat them, but thanks to Rhonda managing to climb halfway into the cab, where she gets stuck, while Val and Earl attempt to ward off attacks by the graboid's tongues, including a very humorous moment when the young man manages to punch one of those snake-like things in the mouth. Rhonda is able to start the truck and press down on the gas pedal before the graboid is able to drag the vehicle down under the ground. The trio head off back to Perfection to warn their friends that the graboids are on the way, and the little town looks like it's going to be a buffet if they can't manage to find a way to get to the safety of the mountains. Because the graboids might be deadly in the dirt, but they can't go through solid rock. And that is where we're going to leave our synopsis, friends. Hopefully this synopsis has given you an appetite to rewatch the film. Or if you've not had the pleasure of seeing it before, seek it out for yourself.
Where do you think the graboids come from, Victor?
The mystery of their origin is a point brought up in the film, listeners. Since obviously no one has ever seen such a creature before, it's Earl who mentions he thinks they're from outer space. Although, the filmmakers leave it all up to the viewers to decide for themselves. Perhaps they are some kind of mutation like Bert suggests. As for myself, I lean towards thinking they are some lost creature from prehistoric times. Maybe they're the ones that killed the dinosaurs.
I agree with Earl Bassett, dear listeners. I feel they are alien in origin.
Well, there have been 4 sequels to Tremors, Projectionist. Actually, 3 sequels and a prequel. In the 4th film, directed by S.S. Wilson, we meet Hiram Gummer, the ancestor of Bert, played by Michael Gross, of course, who settles in the mining community of Rejection, Nevada, in 1889. Spoiler, this obviously becomes Perfection, and the townsfolk there come under attack by a group of graboids, although in this film, they are known as dirt dragons. So while that doesn't exclude alien origin, it does go to show that the filmmakers think that the graboids have been around for quite a while. Now, I can't explain rightfully why the citizens of Rejection wouldn't have passed on the warning of the graboid attacks. I guess they probably wouldn't have been believed, but I think with these kind of sequels, you just have to go with it. For what it's worth, I really like the 4th film. It's a lot of fun. Back in the day, it didn't look like Tremors had done well enough at the box office to get a sequel at all. While it's a low-budget film, coming in at $11 million, it earned only $16 million. However, when it was released to VHS, it just took off like wildfire, thanks to word of mouth. It's been said that sales of the VHS and Laserdiscs brought in $33 million, which is how the direct-to-video and DVD sequels came to be. In the 1996 sequel entitled Tremors 2 Aftershocks, Fred Ward and Michael Gross are the only original cast to reprise their roles, as they face a new breed of graboids. Starting with Tremors 3, the main character of all the sequels becomes Bert Gummer, or his ancestor with the 4th film. In 2015, Tremors Bloodlines was released, and it finds Bert traveling to South Africa to confront the graboids. There was also a short-lived TV series on the Sci-Fi Channel. It, too, featured Michael Gross as Bert Gummer.
So, Kevin Bacon did not return for any of the sequels?
No, though just last year he started the ball rolling on what might either be a reboot of the series or a continuation of Valentine's Saga. I hope it's a continuation of the series myself. Actually, when he was hired for the film, the actor has gone on record saying to The Telegraph that due to a string of box office failures like She's Having a Baby, Criminal Law, and Quicksilver, which I've always liked, by the way, that he was walking in New York with his wife, Kira Sedgwick, who was pregnant with their first child at the time. And he has said he just collapsed on the corner of 86th and Broadway, yelling out, quote, "I can't believe I'm doing a movie about underground worms," end quote. I'd be willing to bet, though, that his co-workers and the filmmakers were able to put his mind at ease. And that $33 million in home video sales certainly couldn't have hurt to prove he had made a right choice. Something that didn't work, it would appear, is the soundtrack for the film. Or I should say, the original composer, Ernest Truss's score, wasn't exactly what the filmmakers wanted. So, Robert Foulkes was brought in to provide over 30 minutes of new score. And it's been pointed out that for some reason, he wasn't given credit for his work.
Perhaps he did it as a favor to the filmmakers.
Could be. Whatever the reason, I think the score as it is now is 100% perfect for the movie. It has a real lazy Western feel to it. Now, I think that about wraps up what we need to talk about. Do you have any vintage drive-in ads to share with the listeners, Projectionist?
I have no ads for this particular radio broadcast. But don't you think we should discuss the special effects? The graboids themselves, Sage?
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. Being filmed in 1990, it means the monsters were obviously practical effects. And I truly have no issue with CGI, if it's handled well, used as the tool it should be to help the filmmakers tell their story. But the Graboids seem more menacing in this film because they were actually on the set for the actors to interact with. I feel that it probably helped with their performances too. The construction of the mechanical beast used in the film were handled by Amalgamated Dynamics. If that effects company sounds familiar to you, it's because they also worked on the likes of Death Becomes Her, Starship Troopers, Hollow Man, and X-Men First Class, to name a few. I've read that the filmmakers wanted something for extreme close-ups, so they requested that a puppet be built for wide shots to be used on miniature sets, where the Graboids could be filmed bursting out of the ground. As for the scenes in the film where you could see the shapes of the monsters under the dirt as they sped forward, this was accomplished by merely using a buoy from a boat. An item that cost about $15, attaching that to a unit vehicle and dragging it along a trough covered by dirt.
It is a rather remarkable looking effect, dear listeners.
Sometimes when it comes to visual effects, there's no school like old school. Now, Ron Underwood would go on to direct 1991's City Slickers, 1993's Heart and Souls, and 1998's remake of Mighty Joe Young. He's been busy of late with TV shows like Once Upon a Time and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. S.S. Wilson and Brent Maddock co-wrote the screenplay for 1993's Heart and Souls, as well as Tremors 2, the Wild Wild West film adaptation, Tremors 3, and its TV series. Kevin Bacon would continue to make a name for himself in 1995's Murder in the First and Apollo 13, as well as 1999's Stir of Echoes, 2003's Mystic River, and just recently in 45 episodes of the TV series The Following. Fred Ward would go on to appear in the likes of 1992's Thunderheart and Bob Roberts, 1998's Invasion Earth TV series, and recently was seen in HBO's True Detective. Finn Carter went on to appear in the TV series China Beach, in the film Ghosts of Mississippi, and the TV series Judging Amy. Michael Gross has not stopped working, friends, appearing on everything from ER to The Young and the Restless to How I Met Your Mother. And friends, unless the sky opens up and we are sucked away, on our next show we will be discussing 1984's Gremlins.
You should not be joking about such things, Victor.
Yeah. I think that about wraps up the episode. On behalf of The Projectionist and myself, we thank you for listening to the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you hear at the beginning of the show was provided by Peachy. If you'd like to contact him, you may do so at peachy@retroist.com. Our new ending theme is entitled Twisted Toys and was composed by the talented Tony Longworth. You can listen to even more of his music on SoundCloud and on his official site, which you can reach at www.tonylongworth.com. Of course, I have to give thanks for the invaluable feedback to my co-host, The Projectionist.
I do my best, Sage. It's not like I can go anywhere until he falls asleep, dear listeners.
Ahem. We do have a Saturday Frights Facebook page as well, and we would greatly appreciate it if you could stop by and give us a like, or even let others know about it. It's another spot where we can share our love of retro horror with you and not have to wait until Saturday to do so. Our podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher. We would greatly appreciate it if you could leave us a nice review if you're pleased with our work. I can be found nearly every day on The Retroist. If you have any suggestions for future shows or even feedback, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. We owe a great debt of gratitude to The Retroist himself. When you have retro needs, and we all do, just head over to www.retroist.com. Until next time, remember to replace your car speaker on its post before leaving the drive-in as we play the trailer from the subject of our next show.
Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins. They're clever. They're mischievous. They'll get into the kitchen, the basement, the garage. They'll get into anything. And once they get in, you're in for it. Gremlins, they'll be expecting you. Directed by Joe Dante, rated PG.
This has been a Retroist production. Goodbye.